Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 7th day of January, 2023. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Parenting is a journey, a fascinating, thrilling, often challenging, and tremendously gratifying journey. It is an experience that enriches your life and makes you a better you, but it can be really, really hard. Now, that's a quote from BetsyBrownBraun.com, the website of my guest today, who, not coincidentally, is named Betsy Brown Braun. This is the 12th time that Betsy has been a guest on, will have been a guest on this show since her first appearance here some 11 years ago. So we go back quite a distance. Betsy is a child development and behavior specialist, parenting educator, and maybe most important, mother of three children and grandmother of six grandchildren. Betsy Brown Braun, welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks, Stephen. It's so nice to talk again. I'm always happy to chat with you.
It is always my pleasure. You came up with a great idea to start us off with today. And as I've thought more about it, you thought more about it. We spoke briefly before we went on the air. We are both grandparents, which means we both have adult children who are now parents themselves. And that gives us a lot of territory to explore, because what our job was when we were first parents and we had little children, babies, and then toddlers, and then preschool and elementary school children, it was very different than when they became teenagers, than when they became young adults, and it changed altogether when they got married, and then it changed utterly again as they had children. What are your initial thoughts? Where would you like to start with this?
I have so many directions I could go with regard to this. I want to tell you a funny little story to start. Some years ago, I do all these seminars and topical seminars. In addition to all the parenting groups that I run, I do topical seminars, one on teaching your kid about death, teaching your child about, one on discipline, about how to explain sex to your children, blah, blah, blah. And I created one as a result of so many questions and complaints, for lack of a better word, from parents. And it was called In-Laws and Outlaws. And
I like
that. Was a darn good seminar. And I, in fact, created two seminars. One was for adult children, now parents, in-laws and outlaws. And one was for the in-laws and the outlaws, for the parents. The one for the parents, in-laws and outlaws, was an overflow crowd. I had to turn people away. The one for the parents, I kid you not, I got three couples. And I think that's an interesting way to begin this conversation.
What did that mean to you?
Well, what that meant to me is that it meant many things, but for purposes of today, our roles as parents shift so radically in reality as our children get older, as they get married, and when they have children. And I was going to say to you before, Stephen, it's not only for your adult children who are now parents, but it's also for your adult children who don't have kids. But that role shifts and shifts and shifts. The children, adult children, really want to know, how can I do this? How can I deal with this? This is hard on me. And the parents, in answer to your question of what did that mean to me, feel like, you know what? I'm okay. I don't need to hear how to do it. I'm just doing it my way. And it was an indicator for me, indicative of how hard it is sometimes for us adults, us parents and grandparents, the older gen, to shift and see it from our kids' perspective. We sometimes don't want to hear. We kind of get stuck in, I'm the parent, this is the way, I know better, or whatever. So that's what it meant to me.
As a child, I remember being 4 years old and knowing I would get married and knowing I would be a father. And I remember practicing all sorts of things, asking people a million questions about marriage and about parenting and what do they think. And whenever I saw, I was born in 1953. So as I was a teenager, the wave of divorces swept the country. And I would ask anyone who was getting a divorce, was it a good marriage that went bad, or were you two people who never should have gotten married? Got some fascinating answers. I'd asked so many questions, read books, researched things, did papers on it in college. And I did the same thing for my career as an attorney to prepare and for investments and all the things I did. I never gave a thought to being a grandparent. I never gave a thought to being the parent of adult children. And boy, is it different, and boy, is it complicated. Parenting adult children is so different than parenting anything prior. It's utterly different.
Right. You know, we've spent their whole growing years, hopefully, trying to create kids who are independent, self-reliant, resilient, who can take care of themselves. And yet, when they try to do that, we balk. You know, it's like, wait a minute, you can't do that, or you didn't ask me, or I don't think you ought to be doing that. You know, it's very hard to elongate the cords, not cut them, but elongate them. Yes, it's interesting to me in your story of being a little boy and asking questions. What's interesting about that is I don't think anything can prepare you really for this role as grandparent or as adult parent of a parent of adult children. But what we do hear about is all the good stuff. Oh, you're going to love being a grandma. There's no, you know, it's so great. You can love the kids and then they go home and you don't have to deal with the bad stuff. I mean, you hear all the good. You don't really get to hear about the parts that are so hard. The only bit of advice I think I ever heard was to the in-law mother at the wedding, which is, open your purse, close your mouth, and wear beige. And that, I mean, that says a lot, right? Close your mouth, open your wallet, wear beige. It is a role. And in pertinent to what we're saying today, Stephen, your role as an in-law parent is really different than your role as the bio parent.
I find myself giving direction and suggestions in a way that I don't do with anyone else with my own kids. They're adults, they're married, they have kids of their own, they have careers, they're independent, they're successful, they're happy. And yet I'll start drawing things to their attention that I wouldn't dream of. Why don't you drink more water? That would be better for you if you drank. I think you might be dehydrated. Just such simple things. And I blow it every third day. And I determine every time I'm not going to do that. And then I do it all over again.
You know, I was with my daughter, and we do need to talk about the difference between fathers parenting daughters and sons. Senior parenting daughters and sons, and mothers, there's a difference in the way we relate to our daughters and sons. There's no question about it. But I was recently with my daughter in Milwaukee, where it was -7 degrees. Let me just be clear about that. And she had a little something on her cheek, and I reached up and I kind of flicked it, and she pulled away from me. She said, "Stop it." And I laughed and I said, "Of course, stop it." You know, but when our babies are babies, we own those bodies. We
yep.
take care of them. We wipe their tushies.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
But when they're grown up, we don't get to mess with their bodies. That's not our bodies. You wouldn't do that to your friend.
No.
You might tell her she has spinach.
No.
But you wouldn't flick at her face.
No. And that's the thing. And I find myself, the other thing I find when they ask me, "How are you doing?" I say, "Well, I'm trying to figure out my role." And it's, yeah, I've been saying that now for, they've been the youngest, let's see, middle son got married in 2009. He was the first one to get married. So what's that now? 14 years.
14 years.
And I've been saying it since then. And they look at me like, "What are you trying to figure out?" They have no understanding of the confusion that comes from this change. I remember when Philly and I got married, which is now 44 years ago, though I think you've got me beat, right? How many years?
We just did 52.
There you go. So 44 for me and 52 for you.
Years, good for us.
Years, yes, excellent. And what was clear to me is we talked at that time about Philly's parents and my parents, and we could just get a little glimpse maybe of what they might be. I had no idea. And our kids, even though I've described it, tried to explain it, no idea what it is to be standing there and see something and have to just stand back. Because when you're the parent of a small child, you are responsible. You need to say,
yes.
You need to do, you need to manage, you need to lead, you need to set examples, you need to think about it all the time. And as a grandparent or a parent of an adult child, your main job is to stand back and just let it happen, especially because nobody's going off the cliff. I think it'd be different. Yeah, I think it is different. If you have an adult child who's in trouble, then I would say something different. But it this piece of it is harder in this way.
You know, Stephen, I want to go back to what you just said. It would be different if you had a child in trouble. Well, of course, yes. But as you were talking, I'm thinking, okay, when something terrible happens, when my son-in-law was in a terrible biking accident, terrible, required a hospitalization, we were the first call my daughter made. She called home. When there is a tragedy, when there is help, when there is something bad happens, it's kind of a mixed message. They call home, they call mommy, they call daddy.
Same here.
Yeah. So I think what I'm wanting to say here is that I think we get very mixed messages about our roles. Here's an example. My kids come home. No one lives in this area anymore, which is a heartbreak beyond description. But my son, who used to live in LA, moved to North Carolina, to Charlotte last year.
Wow.
So, all right. But when they come home, which isn't really their home, but when they come back to 847 Greentree, they walk in and they take on the roles that they used to play when they were growing up in this house. Whether it's how they treat one another as siblings, or whether it's they kind of own everything. They open the fridge, they look at the cupboards, I'm going to take your, so we get these mixed messages. Leave me alone. I'm independent. This is my life. I'm an adult. And by the way, I'm still a kid and this is what I do in the home. It's not confusing, but it's a mixed message.
I feel
sure.
Much better knowing it's their fault.
Yes.
It is complicated, and you know that you're still important. You know that you still matter. You can still make a contribution, but there's a balancing act. Now, children in law, I think for most, it's a very different thing. I've got a very different relationship with my two daughters-in-law and my son-in-law, and that is that they've actually said plainly they welcome suggestions with regard to their children. They like the idea of getting input. And it's interesting to me that they actually are, all three of them will be less reactive, less resistant than our own kids. And I think that's because of all the history since childhood with our own kids. I mean, good history overwhelmingly, but still there seems less resistance from our children-in-law when we finally are making suggestions. Do you find that?
Well, it's an interesting point. First of all, I think that, yes, I want to address that, but I just want to say this. Our relationship with our in-law children, to my mind and from my experience, I think is an outgrowth and a reflection of that child's relationship with his or her parents. For example, one of my son's wives has a wonderful relationship with her mom and dad, and they're close and they're involved and it's just lovely. And we happen to love their, as we call them in Yiddish, some machatunim. And therefore, that daughter-in-law is very very willing and open to ask me questions and to, you know, want to talk about things. Another daughter-in-law, I don't think had the relationship with her parents at all that the first one did. And it is infrequent that I'm asked questions by her. So that's an interesting point. I will posit this for you, Stephen. Can you imagine what it's like for my kids to be around me with their kids?
Because of what you do for a living as a teacher, a parent, a parenting advisor, and so forth. What do they? Are they intimidated?
I think all kids, just like young kids, want their mommies and daddies to be proud of them. I think adult parents want their mommies and daddies to think they're doing a good job. And it's just kind of the nature of the beast. I don't know that they're intimidated, but they're uncomfortable. So I have made it a practice. First of all, I've been told by various of them at various times, you know, I just feel like you're judging. And by the way, I would say, no, I'm not judging, but of course I'm judging. I cannot poke my eyes out. I cannot not be who I am. But I do not offer advice unless I am asked. And that's the hardest thing in the whole world, especially when I see them doing something that I know could be done differently. But I pretty much will, when an adult child says to me, shares something with me, I'll say, is there a question mark on that? That's my response. And more often than not, they'll say no.
So what I have discovered with my children-in-law in particular, I think I've done this with our own kids all along, is that being direct and honest, which is not as easy as it sounds, when I can achieve that, when I can actually get to the place where I can identify what I think and actually say that, not something roundabout or more careful or more diplomatic, but if I can just say what I actually believe, I find that actually works the best. There's risk to it if it's not welcome, but it's generally welcome. But where I get in trouble is I see something and I don't want to be didactic. I don't want to be dictatorial. So I say it sideways, and that's when I find I get in trouble. I think I'm better off when I say,
straight.
Yeah, you know, I think there might be a better way to do what you just did, type of thing. And
I don't disagree with you, but I think those have to be fewer and less often, less frequent, because that in my case, then they feel like they're constantly being scrutinized. I saw, here's another part of the issue. When I had one family staying with me over Christmas, after we got over the break, after we got home, I saw something that drove me up a friggin' wall, pardon my French. And it was this, that one of the children poured himself a bowl of cereal, kind of a bowl the size that you would make a cake mix in, you know, and fill it to the top with cereal and fill it to the top with milk. And then he would eat all of the cereal and leave a good couple inches of milk. And that drove me crazy. It felt so wasteful. So I said nothing. And like the third or fourth day, I said, you know, I think you should pour enough milk that you can drink. Just pour the amount of milk that you're going to drink. I had said nothing, but I couldn't stand the waste.
And you said this to the grandchild?
To the child himself. I stepped in.
How old?
Turning 11 next month.
Got it. Okay.
Perfectly fine. And I think a reasonable thing to say. I didn't say it to the mother because I just wanted to deal with it in a straight, as we said, way. He had every excuse in the book, but I don't like it. I said, I understand. In my house, you pour as much milk as you drink. And he was pissed. He said, do I have to drink this milk? I said, you sure do. I'm not throwing it out. I don't throw out food. So And I'm not crazy. I'm not a member of the Clean Plate Club. This is kind of a different thing. Anyway, he groused around. He was crabby. He was in a bad mood. The next day he poured his milk and he showed it to me. He said, look, this is as much as I poured. And I said, well, you should be proud of yourself. You're not going to be wasteful. It's great. And he left about an inch. I didn't comment. But my point is I made the decision there to deal with the kid and not with the parent. Because what I find is that parents sometimes with some families, they take offense as if you are criticizing them. And that's the tricky part of this. They feel judged. They feel criticized.
In that situation, I would definitely speak directly to the child. I agree. And it wouldn't occur to me to tell the parent or to say it in front of or not in front of the parent. But I would absolutely do that. But I believe that we each have to form our own relationship with each of our own grandchildren. It's not, it's got to be individual and set. And with two of our three kids, they live very close to us, so we see them more frequently. But even with the kids that live 450 miles away, those three grandchildren, when I'm in their presence, I'm giving them suggestions and asking their opinions and asking them what they think all the time. And it's a very direct and personal connection that I'm trying to establish. And it's different than the one that grandma has. I'm going to have a different relationship and it's going to be, it's going to be something different. But to me, that direct communication, I think, is what is necessary.
So I want to ask you another question or a question. And this is a question that's taking us kind of away from the parenting part of it, but it is this. There are grandparents who very strongly feel it is a grandparent's prerogative. I get to do this. I'm the grandma. Number one. And number two, so I'm asking for you to comment on that.
I don't believe that. My view is that when I am with the grandkids, I should be a role model. I should be modeling things. And so the idea that grandparents give their kids more candy or something, it's a good idea for grandparents to spoil their grandchildren.
Yeah.
I don't think that commands self-respect within the grandchild. I don't think it commands respect for me. I don't think it will lead to good things, certainly as they get older. I'm sure they like, if they would like getting more candy when they're 4 or 8 or 10 years old. But when you look forward and you're going to have a 16 or a 24 year old grandchild, I don't think that's going to inure to their benefit or to mine. So no, I don't think grandparents, for me anyway, I don't want a special privilege. I want to act in the position of a role model and a leader and an example and stand for things that make sense rather than say, well, let me make you feel good in the moment. But then that's my whole philosophy of life is feeling good in the moment is swell, but never at the expense of the long range big picture.
Yeah, short-sighted. Well, I knew that you and I would agree on this. What I wanted to say is you would be horrified to know how many grandparents will, number one, not subscribe to that. They say, I get to do it. I don't care what they say. And number two, they will say to the grandchildren, don't tell your parents. Putting them, the poor child, in such a position, modeling dishonesty, modeling secrecy, you know, all kinds of bad things. But my point in bringing it up, Stephen, it is very common. And when I talk about this in my parenting groups, and I say to the I say to the parents, I would never do something, whatever something is, without first checking it out with my kids. Is it okay if they stay up late and watch television? Is it okay? Whatever. Can I buy them this? We're going to go get candy. Is that okay with you? Because I want to be supportive of my children. And the people in my group say, oh, my God, every one of them. I wish I had you for a grandparent. And of course, I say, no, you don't. It's too hard. But but it's really a little scary to me to see how many grandparents choose to take their role in this kind of imperial way.
Yeah, like I've earned the privilege, and now I'm not constrained by having to be a good leader. It doesn't even register with me. I don't understand it. We've done this show together an average of once a year since 2011. And in a previous show, I told you that I thought there were three parenting pillars, and I told you what I thought, what from my point of view, they were. And these can be reorganized by anybody. They aren't official. They're just how I chose to categorize them. And then I got a letter from a listener to the show who said, you left out a fourth one. So here are the three, plus now what I call my four parenting pillars. One is unconditional love and affection. I think that's the job of every parent and grandparent. It is to make sure that your children, grandchildren know you love them. It isn't conditional. It isn't subject to their behavior. It is you love them, you care for them, you care about them. That's number one. Number two is to offer stimulation, exposure to things in the world. And that could be the fine arts, or it could be video games. It could be whatever it would be, but to offer the world to them, to present them with how things work and how things are done, and to experience things so they can decide how they want to do things. Number three, consistency, so that no one has to say, yeah, watch out for dad today because he's in a mood, or I want to ask my dad something, but I got to figure out when to catch him in the right frame of mind. I never wanted to be that. I wanted to be someone who you could count on to be almost comically consistent. And the kids teased me about it when I was when they were teenagers, that they would say something and I would say the usual thing I would say, and they would say, you're so predictable. And my answer was thank you. So consistency. And the one I got from the listener that really was such a natural thing, but it never occurred to me, is modeling. Yeah. I can show my kids better than I can tell them. So my thoughts were love and affection, stimulation, consistency, modeling. Betsy Brown Braun, tell me what you think.
Well, amen to that. But this is what I mean, all of these, modeling is the umbrella under which all of these live, because, of course, it's true for parents with children. But let's take it back to grandparents, because we, when our kids were being raised, and those of us who were lucky enough to have our parents on the scene so that our children got to see how grandparents are treated and incorporated and respected and honored and revered and whatever it may be. And I think, I mean, it's interesting, Stephen, when you think about this from a cultural perspective, and I'm sorry to take us a little bit to the side here, you look at the way the Chinese families treat their grandparents with such tremendous reverence and respect and honor. I see it in my Persian families. I see it in my Japanese families. I see it in my Chinese families. What is interesting on top of that, and this is modeling because we see it happening, then those children grow up. And I am dealing with the first and second generation now of a lot of these kids from different cultures. They were raised in a certain way. The parents were raised in a certain way. And now they raise their children in an American way. But I'm getting confused. I'm confusing the issue. But my point is this, that the kids, the adult kids today, in some respects, they allow their parents, they respect their parents, they include their parents, but the kids today are permissive of allowing their parents to do things, grandparents, to do things with their kids that they know is not right. For example, I have several Persian families. I have a wonderful Persian population in my practice whose parents, meaning the grandparents, are running around the house with spoons trying to feed the kids to get them to eat and doing things we know that you don't do with kids anymore. But the children will not say anything to their parents because they don't want to offend their very respected parents. This is not with American, Caucasian American families. This is, and that Caucasian is not the word I meant to say, American. But I do see it with families who are strongly from another culture, which is another interesting element in terms of the role that grandparents play. And it is a far cry from where you started, which is your beautiful three pillars, and then there's that fourth. But I do think from the modeling perspective, which is how I got us here, I think we model for our children how we treated our parents, and they, many of them, are treating us based on that model.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I can see reflections in things that our kids do with their kids that are directly derivative of what we did. And then they do some things that are very different, and I think sometimes much better. And so I think it appears to me that we each try to take the best of what our parents had to offer and then try to improve on it. And in the process, we probably improve some things and make some things worse. I can certainly see that in changes that I made and that Philly and I made that differently than our parents did, that I could look back on. But I have very few regrets because we paid close attention to it. It is interesting to me when I hear a lot of grandparents say, "I'm a better grandparent than I was a parent."
Oh, I hear it all the time.
And I it surprises me. And yet what I think in a lot of cases, really people who acted in good faith, they were very busy building a career and doing something while they were raising kids. And of course, they were in their 20s and 30s. Now they're in their 50s or 60s or 70s, and they know more than they did. But I hear a lot of people say, "I'm a way better grandparent than I was a parent." And I think sometimes that's right.
I think, I don't know if it's better, because I really agree with what you said, which is, you know, they're doing the best they can do considering the situation at the time. I don't think anybody tries to be a, quote, bad parent. I think everybody wants to raise kids who are satisfied, great citizens of the world, right? And I think that nobody tries to mess it up. But I think, you know, life gets in the way. And priorities, I think, is really undermine sometimes our ability to do our best job, whatever that means. But I don't think anybody is trying to make that error. Rather than judge it and say I'm a better grandparent than I was parent, I think I would prefer to look at it again as that twisty turny pathway of parenting and changing and your roles changing. And I mean, that's what life is with our kids. We want them to look at what they did, mess it up, you know, do better the next time, use that information. Your number two was, you know, stimulation, exposure. Experience is such an important teacher. It reminds me of a kid who came into the kindergarten class I was teaching, and he was really terrified to come to kindergarten. Why? Because he thought he was supposed to know how to read. And so he couldn't do it, you know, and he was really scared. And I think people go into certain situations thinking they're supposed to know how to do it. But life is an accumulation of experiences that enable us to do things better or differently, period.
My father told that very story of he remembered vividly when he was in his 70s. He remembered vividly that he was afraid to go to school as a child at the age of 4 for the first time because he said, "I don't know anything."
Oh.
I thought you had to know something to go to school. And it brings me to a whole different subject. We have kids with different challenges. All kids have different challenges. And let me take a couple of them. You say in one of your blogs at BetsyBrownBraun.com the manner and degree to which a child processes and reacts to his mistakes, accidents, and missteps sometimes can be seen starting at an early age. There are many things at play, some of which come with the factory equipped model and others that reflect the environment in which the child lives. The sensitivity to and or fear of making mistakes or doing something wrong can manifest as a child who won't try new things, who won't speak up in a group, who won't take risks, or who simply falls apart when he thinks he has done something less than expected. Talk about this. What do parents do that cause their kids to fear mistakes? What can parents do to help children be willing to take rational risks?
Well, this isn't certainly another direction, but I'm going to tie it together. Watch this, because I just want to say that we model for our kids taking risks and making mistakes. They just don't get to see us do it. So how great it is to make, let's just say, make a meatloaf and then sit down at the table and say, oh my gosh, this might be the worst meal I have ever made. This is disgusting. Well, I blew it. I tried a new recipe and I blew it. Okay, I learned I need to do this. So one of the things that helps children to feel safe in making mistakes and failing is modeling doing that. So there we go. We tied those things together nicely. Done.
I really like that. I really like that, Betsy, because one of the things I thought was very important was to make sure that my kids knew every mistake I ever made as a child while they were children. And now that they're adults, to keep explaining all the mistakes I make as an adult, I guess I've got a sense of humor about it because I am okay with my mistakes. I better be. I make plenty of them. So I think that's a wonderful point. So
you know,
modeling.
So here we get to the factory equipped model. You are not a person with anxiety. Unless there's something there I haven't seen in the last 12 years. You're not an anxious person. Anxiety has a very high heritability rate, and we get it. It comes through the genes very often and manifests in many ways. But sometimes our fears, by the way, perfectionism is an anxiety disorder. Our fears, our sensitivities, our anxiety get in the way of our wanting to take risks, which means fail, right? Not necessarily, but often means risk failing. And you're not that person because you felt, first of all, you don't have anxiety and you felt secure enough in yourself to do something and to blow it. I am what I call a recovering perfectionist. I'm a sober perfectionist.
Yeah.
And I'm not a perfectionist anymore. I worked hard for many years to not be that person. And believe me, when you're a painter, and you know what I'm talking about because Philly is a painter, it's very easy to fall back into perfectionism, but it is impossible because a painting is never done. It can always be different, better, whatever. So I've had to work very hard to accept that, okay, that didn't work out the way I hoped it would, but it's okay. I can try again. That's something that you have to grow. You can only grow when you feel confident about yourself in other ways. Where does that come from? Which is your question, what can we do? I'm sure we have talked about this many times. We're a far cry from grandparenting right now, but there is something we've talked about called a growth mindset. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So the concept of a growth mindset, which was really pioneered by a wonderful psychologist named Carol Dweck, who was at Columbia, now at Stanford, brilliant. She talked about the difference between a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. Without spending too much time defining all this, although if you'd like me to, I'm happy to. When we raise children, and this is not just for parenting, this is in life. When we raise children with a growth mindset, what we are doing is raising them to not feel like they have a limited capacity to do anything, but that rather they see themselves as capable of trying more, doing it again, that you have the power to make things happen. Whereas when you're raised with a fixed mindset, we don't. We think, this is what I am. I'm smart. Okay, I don't know how I'm smart or what I did to be smart, but I'm smart. As opposed to, wow, you worked really a long time on that, and look at how successful you were, which is a growth mindset. It tells you what you did with that. And I think in this day and age, more people are aware, adults are aware of the importance of a growth mindset in raising our kids. And that is one of the ways that we help them to learn that failure is, you know, there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all, to quote Bob Dylan. So, yes, that we need that failure is an important part of learning and growth.
It's easy when it's easier when kids have early failures. Someone who's an A student from kindergarten on has much, much more pressure on them than someone who messes up and makes mistakes and then discovers success later on, because they know how to take a punch. They know how to fail. And knowing how to fail, the Chinese saying, fall down six times, get up seven, is operative. Where does this anxiety, is this genetic? This, when you talk about people who have anxiety and they're anxious, the temperature drops to 55 degrees and you hear a child start talking about frostbite and they're concerned about frostbite. And then they become more concerned, and a half hour later, they're talking only about frostbite.
But the twist on that, and I will answer your question where it comes from in a second, is, yeah, frostbite happens with people who get cold and don't take care of themselves. What are you going to do to make sure that you're warm enough? Well, you're going to put your mitten liners on, and then you're going to put your mittens over your hands. And then you're going to wear your Smartwool socks before you put on your other socks, and then your shoes, and you will not get frostbite.
And then, having said exactly that, the answer you hear is, I'm still very concerned about frostbite. And then it comes up 3 minutes later, and then 4 minutes after that. Where's that coming from, and what do you do then?
Well, I think I cannot tell you exactly what to do with each child, because nothing happens for no reason. Nothing happens for no reason. And nothing happens singularly. There's always something else going on somewhere else. Something is feeding it, something. So to your question, where does it come from? Some children are born genetically predisposed to be more anxious. And it is about brain structure and brain development, not development, but how their particular brains work and the chemicals in our brains. Some of us are more sensitive and more anxious and more worrying than others. And there is a very, very high heritability rate with this. If you have a mother or Uncle Harry or someone, you could have gotten it easily from that place. I don't know many cases pre-COVID, and I'll say that in a second, of children who just suddenly become anxious. You can see anxiety at a very young age in very small ways. You can see it manifesting. COVID did something to all of us because we were so isolated and so away from a world which enabled us stimulation, exposure, experiences, and the world number two pillar. We were so far away from it that children weren't able to experience their power in making things happen. So there was no trial and error. So we saw kids post-COVID, mainly middle school on up, not so much elementary school, who were terrified of, they didn't know how to talk to boys. They didn't know how to be in school. They forgot how to do homework. They weren't having reinforcing experiences that helped them to have success in the world. So we are seeing more anxiety now. But I have a blog trying to get written. It's kind of bouncing around in my head right now about the difference between worry and anxiety. And I think everybody is talking about anxiety now. And I don't think many people have the anxiety that is diagnosed, that is a diagnosable condition. I think a lot of people have worries and concerns that we're misdiagnosing as anxiety.
So one of the responses that that I gave is the one you and I just talked about. So let's talk about frostbite, that you, the liners and then the mittens, and you won't be exposed for that long and it isn't that cold. And so you are not going to get frostbite. That was one response, is there's nothing to worry about. But when it persisted, the approach that I took was that, well, so you're anxious, so you'll learn from this. Maybe what will happen when you don't get frostbite is that the next time you're concerned about something, you know, like a werewolf, you'll be able to talk yourself through it and decide whether or not it should be a real fear, or whether you're just working yourself up for a problem that doesn't exist.
Well, that depends on the age of the child. That's very hard for a child under the age of 10 to do.
God, I thought you were going to say 30.
No, because the older we get, the more experience we've had, and we can use past experience to help assuage the anxiety. But I agree with number one, but your number one, your number two. But I would put number two as the validation of the anxiety, that it's a parent's job to say, yes, I hear that you're still worried about that. You are very worried that that's going to happen. What would you like me to say to help you to feel less worried? What would you like me to do? What do you think can be done? I mean, helping the child as opposed to the parent telling the child, you know, do this, do this, do this. What do you think you can do to help yourself feel? Here, I had a case recently of a child who was terrified to go to, it was Disney on Ice, I believe. And he didn't like, he's a kind of a spectrum-y kid. And he was worried about going because he didn't want the lights to be out and he didn't like the noise. And so his parents had a chat with him about covering his ears. When something is too loud, you cover your ears. And that was his idea. And he actually went and had quite a successful experience, covered his ears a lot of the time. So, you know, we need to validate and not to talk him out of it and not to, you know, not to disallow his feelings. We have to validate their real feelings that he's having. We may not agree with them, but they are real. So I would put that as number two, and then number three, as you said.
So then, aside from an anxiety over frostbite and 55-degree weather or werewolves and so forth, there are some things to be concerned about, like traffic accidents or bicycle accidents or falling off the couch, or as unusual and very few and far between, rare as they are, kidnappings and school shootings, to be sure, those are problems and they need to be dealt with by society, but they're rare. Far more often, accidents, bicycle, car falling is what endangers children. How do you strike the balance between safety awareness and fear so that the kids have enough attention on risks, real world physical risks, but they're not unreasonably held back by it?
Stephen, if you and I knew the answer to that, can you imagine? It's like finding the Alzheimer's drug. Yeah. There isn't one clear answer to that. How do you strike the balance? It depends on the child. It depends on what, you know, what his chemical makeup is, what's going on with him, what experience he has had in the past. But I think a healthy fear is not a bad thing. I believe in healthy fear. That's what we try to create in kids about crossing the street when they're little. That's what we're trying now desperately for all our teenagers, to have a healthy fear of buying some kind of a drug on Snap and discovering that it's laced with fentanyl, right? We want a healthy fear is a good thing.
You know, but, so I got to tell you a story in the middle right there. When all three of our kids had met all three of their spouses, they didn't have grandchildren yet. And so this is in about 2010 or 2011. And we were in a parking lot, and there was a car coming through the parking lot. And I said in a loud voice, "Car." All three of my kids who we raised looked up, looked around to find the car, which was quite far away, to find the car. All three of my children-in-law to be didn't even hear me. It wasn't. So, yes, I had in parking lots, we're in a parking lot, guys, created an immediate reaction of head on a swivel, take a look, stand closer to me or stand closer to this parked car and don't get run over and squished.
Yes.
So, you want to create that. Can you give me some specific examples with particular kids or particular conditions where parents reacted properly or improperly, creating appropriate fear or inappropriate fear of real world risks? And I suppose that could also include the unlikely ones, the more rare ones like school shootings and kidnappings and shark attacks.
How I wish I could say to a child, there is not going to be a school shooting. You have nothing to worry about. We can't.
No, we can't. Okay, good. We may have finally, after 11 years, found something we might not agree on. I think you can say that if you want something to worry about physical harm that may come to you, worry about riding your bike out into the street. Worry about climbing up on something and falling off. Worry about not paying attention in a parking lot and getting hit by a car. You want to worry about something, school shootings should be way down the list. Kidnapping should be way down the list. Worry about not tying
stuff
your
you
shoes.
Can control.
Yeah. Well, stuff
I agree
you
with
can
you.
Control and stuff that's more likely as opposed
right.
to really, really unlikely. As
you know, Stephen, I'm interrupting you to say this. Sorry. You're young. You'll remember. I won't remember. here's an example. A parent said to me, this is a couple of years ago, my school is now doing active shooter drills. How do I explain this to my 5-year-old? And it was someone who actually lived in the Palisades, where I live. And, you know, that's a really tough thing to explain to a kid. It's not really going to happen. Probably won't happen. But so the only way I found that could make sense to why, because we don't want to say to these children, there are people who are crazy, who are angry, who have problems, who want to kill people, right? That's just not something I think we have to bring up at this age, because I think that causes unrest and fear and anxiety and, you know, trepidation and all of that. But we talked about saying, you know, we live very close to the mountains. And sometimes an animal might come in, which is, by the way, true. There was a mountain lion right in the village of the Palisades last week. So he could wander into school. So there's all different kinds of dangers that teachers need to protect children from. Could be a mountain lion, could be somebody's on campus who's not supposed to be. So that's why we have the drills. Okay. I agree with you, but I also, listen, percentages, you're absolutely right. You know, you would say to a child, every time we get in the car, you fasten your seatbelt. I don't think we're going to crash. The chance of our crashing is so remote. I'm a very careful driver. But we put it in our seatbelt anyway. I think it's the way parents deliver the message. I think it's what we say. And to answer your initial question, parents will say, well, I don't know. I don't think you can. You better not ride your bike two houses down because there could be a stranger on the lawn. The way we deliver the admonition really does contribute to a child's anxiety and fear.
Well, I thought we were going to disagree, but we don't. The seatbelt is exactly the answer I would give the 5-year-old who's getting a school drill on school shootings and how to deal with an active shooter. The answer would be exactly the seatbelt. We're going to wear a seatbelt. We don't have accidents. You haven't had an accident. We don't expect to have an accident. And yet, we're going to wear the seatbelt every time we ride in the car because it's just a low cost.
It's low, what we do.
Low burden, high benefit for a low probability but high impact event. So we're going to be very careful that way. And that's why we talk about active shooters, not because we expect one, but because you need to be prepared for anything, and then you live your life. So,
but that's what we were saying before, Stephen, which is one of the things that we do is we tell them what they do in the event. And kids with high anxiety will say, but what if, and there is nothing you can say to that child to calm down the chemical reaction he's having in his brain.
I want to finish with a whole different subject, as unbelievably we get close to the end of this hour. One of my law partners tells the story of when he was a child and they got a hamster or a gerbil or something, and then the gerbil got pregnant and had eight babies.
And the eight
sounds babies,
like me.
Yeah. And the eight babies, out of the eight babies, seven of them had normal expected limbs, and one of them had a stub instead of a front right paw.
Mm-hmm.
All the other seven had four paws. And they noted this and they talked about it. And the following morning when they came out, the mother gerbil had chewed off the front right paw on all the other seven gerbils.
Amazing.
And it occurred to me when my partner, my law partner, Fred, told me this story, as it occurred to him, when this happened when he was a child, there are parents who do this with when they have multiple children, boys, girls, two children, four children, six children, that there's some parents might tend to equalize. And the gerbil, I don't think it was a good idea for the gerbil to do this to the other seven babies.
That money was not right.
That was not right. But I see this from time to time with parents in treating children one way because one child cannot do or has a challenge or a problem. Have you seen this? And what have you seen?
Well, you've left us, 3 minutes to talk about this. Could be an entire session. Here's the reality. Children, there's no reason to expect your children to be alike, even if they are identical multiples. Children are different. They are a different combination of different genes, of experiences, of life. And one of your number five pillar might be, let's put our children in a position of being able to deal with their experience, their life, and live the life they need to live. Thinking that fair means equal is a tremendous mistake. Because there's no such thing. All children are different, and we parent each of our children differently. I don't care. Your children had different fathers, even though you're Stephen.
100%.
That's the reality.
And we said often, why are you doing it this way with them and you're doing it the other way with me? Well, because you're different. They're different. Right. You're different. Fair is not equal is exactly what we said a million times.
Yep. There you have it.
Betsy Brown Braun, I want to say thank you. You all-around parenting person, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I learn something every time. It's always thought-provoking. I deeply appreciate it and look forward to doing this again soon.
Stephen, you know how much I enjoy it too, and I hope so soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Betsy Brown Braun, an all-around parenting person. I suggest that you take a look at BetsyBrownBraun.com. There are all sorts of blogs and features. It's a very nice website. You can also buy one or both of the books that you can see right now on the TalkRadio1.com website. The first one is You're Not the Boss of Me, and the other book is called Just Tell Me What to Say. These are excellent books. We talked about them years ago on the show specifically, so we can go back. If you send me an email, I'll send you links to Betsy's past programs. And you can go and listen to those where we talk about those books. Those are still excellent books that hold up very well today. And so I recommend them. Betsy's services, and you can contact her through BetsyBrownBraun.com, include private consultations, parenting groups, individual seminars, school, business, and community presentations. In addition, Betsy consults on issues of divorce, including custody, as well as on school placement for preschool and elementary school. So take a look. Betsy Brown Braun, B-R-A-U-N, BetsyBrownBraun.com. My next show will be 1 week from today. My guest might be Douglas Brinkley. We're still trying to coordinate logistics. He's been on the show before. He's a noted historian, has written many excellent books. We've had him on before. He is wonderful. If he can do that, that's great. If not, we'll do something else. That is 1 week from today, next Saturday, January 14, 2023, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. If you will, please use our Amazon, eBay, and PayPal links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com to keep these podcasts available to you at no cost. My email address, Steve@TalkRadio1.com, Steve@TalkRadioONE.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.